Hi, I'm here with Wayne, my friend. How are you doing? Have you come down from the high of last weekend yet?
No, and I don't expect to. I think we've indulged in the lows too often, and we've made hay of the lows on this podcast. We've indulged quite merrily in them, so if we get a high, I'm going to squeeze the milk out of that, especially because we don't have a game this weekend. I'm just going to pretend that it's the result this weekend as well. I'm a little bit disappointed, Ed, that when you did the count test before, you went 1-2-1-2, and you didn't do 4-3-4-3, which you do to test the levels before. But that's how much I'm going to milk this. I'm going to use it, shoehorn every reference I can, as much as I can, throughout this podcast. That might be the only one.
Look, it was a historic game, and massive in the context of where United are at right now, but just massive just anyway. A victory in the last minute in a 4-3 game in the quarterfinal of the FA Cup against your biggest rivals at Old Trafford. It's one to be celebrated. I did see some weird, I mean, of course, like any take you could possibly get, you'll find on the internet. But there were quite a few people going, oh, this club, man, you're celebrating like you've won the league, won the Champions League or whatever. And I was like, come on. If you can't enjoy this, you can't enjoy football.
Exactly. I had one of those when I was at the game, and I tweeted a few videos and pictures from it, and just a few thoughts after, because it is football is a universal thing, and we're talking about Manchester United, and so obviously when you're talking about your club, it kind of precludes all other clubs. You talk about it in this way that it's almost like your club has sole ownership over the emotional context of anything to do with football, but obviously that's not the case. But there are certain elements that you fall in love with your club about, and United do have a strong narrative history of pulling these kind of results out of the bag. And yeah, I had that, you know, you're celebrating like you've won the cup. No, I mean, obviously, if we do win the cup, then the context of what we experienced on Sunday will be magnified and emphasised even more. But even by its own standards, you're talking, Old Trafford is a famous stadium, and the number of memories that we've had there, you know, like Barcelona 84, even scoring, I think it was Stapleton 83 against Everton, where they said that it's the loudest noise ever recorded at Old Trafford. But and then City 4-3 with Michael Owen. One of the things I was hoping we were going to talk about today was the historical context of the importance of the game, but maybe not, because I think when you do that, then you start talking about the City 4-3, and then by placing one in front of the other, it's almost like you're detracting the other. And I'm not quite there. I'm too celebratory mood for that. But it's something that is historic. It's the two biggest clubs in England playing possibly the best ever game that's been competed between them, decided in the most, and not in terms of like technical quality and everything like that, but just an entertaining game and the drama and everything like that. And there's this storyline of Klopp going for all the trophies and United desperately needing to cling on to the last hope of silverware that they've got, with Ten Hag trying to muster his own path in United folklore. So many different stories. So even with the goal scorers and everything like that, football, Manchester United and Liverpool, more than any other clubs in the country, football for those clubs, football is determined by silverware and where they stand. But you don't win. Man United have won 20 league titles in 140 years. So in the rest of that time, what's football made of? It's made of memories, what we saw on Sunday. Exactly. And you can't have anything as rich as that, really. You can't have anything as rich as that.
Well, look, and the other side of that kind of thought about the historic high and the win is the historic low and the misery that Liverpool fans have been suffering all week. And can we just have a moment for them to enjoy it? Quite a lot.
we can. I mean, well, have a think of this, though, Ed. Like, it was not too long ago, we watched Liverpool, and I sat through the whole thing, unfortunately, where Liverpool came to Old Trafford and won 5-0. Now, there's merits to winning 5-0, and obviously you would crow about that for years, rightfully so. But that's the fine line in football, isn't it? Like, a 5-0, a 4-3 in the last minute, which on the balance of play you scarcely deserve. I think we did deserve it, but it's still scarcely. You've won it narrowly, in the unlikeliest of circumstances, and you play, you know, you play with Antony and Bruno Fernandes in defence. But the euphoria is exactly the same, right? Would you have felt any better if we'd won 5-0? It'd feel great, don't get me wrong, but it wouldn't feel any better.
You don't get that, just, that, like, that big moment. Thankfully, there was no, like, fine margins on the pass and having a VAR check it or anything like that to take away from that fine moment.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, that was excellent, and we can keep talking about it, and we can keep peppering in some comments throughout this pod. There's a few other United stories this week. I don't know whether you got the chance to listen to it, but Jim Ratcliffe did an interview on the Geraint Thomas podcast. So I listened to the whole thing. I mean, he's pretty consistent with what he said before, but I think a few nice nuggets in there and just kind of little refreshing stuff. I mean, we heard more from him in that one podcast and the other media interviews he's done in the last few weeks than we heard from the Glazer boys in 20 years. So, like, number one, pretty refreshing. Yeah. He's very honest and straightforward, isn't he? He also said, quote, he hates them all when it comes to Liverpool, City and Arsenal when he was asked who he'd like to win the league. Good answer. Solid answer. Yeah. So he gets it as well, because I don't think that was manufactured. And look, there's many questionable things about him and his wealth and business practices and tax status and politics, like, people may or may not agree with him and all of that kind of stuff. And let's just say the questionable governments that his company does business with, because that's where oil is. So there's many of those things. So I'm not here to lionize him particularly, but just the refreshing honesty and openness and willing to participate in an in-depth discussion was kind of interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah. I will say on that as well, before we talk about the podcast, just on what you were saying there, the political aspects of everything. I felt like if we did got Qatari ownership, every single conversation would have to come with that caveat. You couldn't enter into any conversation about that. I do think there isn't really the need for that. You could talk about it once, and we, I know we have covered it on the podcast as well. I don't think because there's no good billionaire, really. Everyone's got...
Yeah.
Bad scruples. I don't feel like, you know, every time we talk about Ratcliffe and his wealth and his benevolence in association with Manchester United, that it has to come with the caveat that he does dodgy, that some of his business avenues are questioned in terms of morals.
I'm not here to say, like, one billionaire is better than the other, and I particularly dislike billionaires as a class of people or anything like that just for the sake of it. But yeah, I mean, I don't think he's the worst by any means. And anyway, and you're right. I'm not going to contextualize it every time we talk about him. But, you know, I sometimes in my head, I'm like, I don't want to go. I don't want to do what the Chelsea and City fans have done, which have a banner for the guy on the Stretford End. And like, because I don't think that we necessarily need to celebrate owners like that. What I do like, I think, is his willingness to talk about it, and not just it being like issues around Manchester United or him being a fan or kind of understanding sentiment, but also just like his thinking around sports and strategy for sports, and to use a word that you used in the build up to the pod, he didn't seem that conniving about all of it. It was kind of refreshing that he just kind of said, well, we had the opportunity and so we did it. And yeah, we bought an F1 team because, I don't know, like, I was like, I mean, that's what I do sometimes. I roll out of bed and I'm like, I'll buy an F1 team today. Yeah. So.
Yeah. He did come across in that way, didn't it? Very sort of as casual a conversation as you can have with a multi-billionaire. And I guess there's a good thing to that. I mean, is there an element of that that's disingenuous? Maybe there is, that he's talking on your level, do you know, like in the same way that, you know.
No, I think he's very comfortable in his own skin.
No, that's what I think. I'm just putting the question out there. But when you listen to it, there's not a part of me that feels like it's disingenuous. It's just the if you read the words on a page without listening to the tone, which, you know, I have done on the podcast, then you might think, oh, that's a little bit rich, pardon the pun. But there are things in the content of what he talks about. I mean, I don't know if you can remember this, but there was a video clip from a few, many, many years ago now, when Avram or Joel Glazer they were giving a talk about United history at a college in the US, and they got a simple fact wrong. And, you know, right, that happens from time to time. I'm not digging them out for that. of all the different things that have been dug out about them. What I mean is, when you've got someone like Ratcliffe who spoke with the refreshing honesty of genuinely being a fan, to the extent that he's been on record as saying that his favourite player was Eric Cantona, but then when he was pressed, and this is very small detail, but it matters to someone like me, when he was mentioning who he thinks the best player who has played for the club is, he said Ronaldo, because he sat down with Sir Alex and Sir Alex said that he's the best player he ever coached, and from that point of view. But then he went a little bit further and he said Bobby Charlton because of the story that he had, and then really George Best because of the natural talent that he had. There's probably never been a more gifted footballer. And these are the only similarities that I've got with Jim Ratcliffe, but I would probably give that answer exactly the same in terms of, yeah, all right, Ronaldo might go down as the greatest ever player, but Cantona was my favourite. But I would still say I've Best as the greatest, and Charlton as the greatest story and everything like that. So he's so in tune. I'm not saying that I'm necessarily in tune, but what I mean, he's in tune with what I feel about the football club. So I feel more secure when I listen to him and all the other stuff.
And that didn't feel like it was a prepared statement or anything like that. It was just his
thoughts. No. He's a naturally sort of flowing thing. And the other thing that I find interesting, we have talked about it before, is the willingness to accept that United have been second rate. And I don't mean second best. I mean second rate in a long period of time. And the way that he's addressed that, and he's been that open about it, which obviously it's a bold step for anyone to take, because he's taken responsibility for improvement then. He's not like over the last 10 years where there's been Woodward and there've been the Glazers and the spinners being that United can do things that other clubs can't do and United are still the greatest and everything like that. So there's a frank and open admission that we're not where, and I know we've heard it like repeatedly for the last 3 months, but it is still refreshing to hear that we've got that ground to cover and to hear the detail in which he talked about that and the steps that we already know have been taken, but the way that he's addressing that, there's no kind of false, like saying we're going to be here in a week, we can do things, even down to the sort of Mbappe soundbite that's been going around. All of these things are, you can't listen to that and not be reassured, really.
He just strikes me as a man with a lot of composure and comfort in his own thoughts. And look, through my career and in a previous life, I spent a lot of time with the executives. And like what you tend to get is composure. Right? And a part of that is training. I've done that. And it helps you kind of organize your thoughts in a way that gives comfort to others. Part of that is his comfort in his own skin. And I actually know two billionaires. This is not like name dropping. I'm not going to one of them I invited to speak to our board, which is 30 CEOs. And it's a fairly intimidating atmosphere, as you can imagine. This is in a previous life role. And he turned up on his private jet and had his 11-year-old daughter interview him as his presentation. It always struck me, that one. I was like, yeah, you're pretty comfortable. It wasn't fuck you money. Yeah. He wasn't being a dick. He just knew about himself. And Ratcliffe comes across like that, and he's very assured. And look, we can pick apart the details of what he said, and there are some kind of interesting things in there, but I think just generally, he's natural, comfortable, and has some clarity of thought. And what I particularly like about what you were saying about the saying United are second rate, basically, and we're behind, is there's no hiding place for the rest of the team at Manchester United. I mean, there's players, coaches, executive team at all. They can't go, no, actually, I think we want second rate, because the evidence is there, isn't it? So, and there has been a lot of hiding places, I think, over the last decade or so, and no longer. And there's a real clarity around what they're doing. Omar, as he called him, will be arriving in the summer. He didn't really talk about Ashworth, but that will get done at some point. Yeah. And he's been very clear about the structure that needs to be built. And he wouldn't really answer any questions about who should be the next manager or anything like that, as you can kind of expect, I think. Yeah. He's clear about, I mean, he says this thing where you organize the structure and the results fall out of the bottom. I mean, it's kind of simplistic, but at least there's real clarity there.
Yeah. Oh, you wouldn't want him to start saying stuff like that as well. I think that's a responsible, like he's been an owner at Nice. I still think for someone who's experienced as what he is, you'll still have to get used to the profile of Manchester United. And it sounds weird, but it will, because everyone does who comes into that arena, because it's so intense, and anything that you say, especially that high up, every word is scrutinized by the press, to the point where it's the last thing that you said is over deliberated so many times until the next time you say something. And so to not come out, to not even entertain the conversation of what he's looking for in a manager is wise, because it would only invite speculation. Now, there's a story I know we're going to talk about with the Southgate thing. The thing to remember with anything that's, although we're sounding, oh, we're feeling confident with everything that he's saying, is that he's still going to be making decisions, and those decisions are still going to be right or wrong. And there's no guarantee, just because we like what he's saying now, sure, that we'll agree with the decisions that he'll make. And that'll be an interesting thing, because I'm braced for the fact that I'm not going to like every decision, because we never like every decision. You know, it'd take a real hardcore United fan, like the lad who was on Arsenal Fan TV, to really agree with everything that the club does all the time, every decision that everyone makes at the top. So you've got to brace yourself for the fact that some unpopular decisions have to be made. But I mean, that's part of progress as well, that it was unpopular to sell Whiteside and McGraw in 1989. Unpopular, very unpopular, because they were two of the club's greatest ever players, but it was necessary in order to progress. And we're probably going to have a few of those decisions in the near to mid future.
Well, he did say they'd made a lot of mistakes. I mean, at Lucerne and Nice. So, Lausanne.
Good, huh?
And look, that's good, right? He's got the mistakes out of the way and they've learned from it. And they have had quite a few changes, both in terms of they operated without a director of football at Nice for a little while, and went through a few questionable managers, let's say. And then he went for someone a bit younger, and they've kind of gone for this idea they're going to get quite young players and build that way, quite young manager and quite young players. Lausanne has been a bit trickier because he installed his brother and they've been relegated and come back up. He said they're an interesting club, but we didn't really go any further than that. But yeah, made mistakes. But he also talked about like other sport, and that was kind of interesting as well, because he talked about the F1 stuff and the cycling team, and I think he'd probably admit, although he didn't go into real depth, that they'd made a few mistakes there too. A great cycling team lost its two biggest stars, and then they're not very good anymore. That sort of thing. I don't really know much about cycling. It's blokes pedalling a lot, isn't it?
No, but he reminds me of it when Southampton got Clive Woodward in after he'd done well with the Rugby World Cup.
Yeah.
I'm not really using that as a comparison, but what I mean is when you've got someone who's experienced across lots of different disciplines, particularly, like you said, at executive level, their capacity for problem solving is more out of the box, and it's better. Would you say it's better, it's healthier to have someone who's got the capacity to think not just within the football spectrum? I know the football spectrum is unique.
Yeah. I don't know that the actual football decisions will be made by Brailsford. And actually, Ratcliffe has said over and over that, you know, Dave wouldn't say he's the most knowledgeable about football, right? So, but that's why they've got Omar Berada and Ashworth coming in and others.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. So who have been involved with football for a long time. But I do think the kind of general capacity for thinking strategically, which I think Brailsford like indexes very high on, that is important, and you can apply it to any domain. So just the process and the thought process of how to do that. Yeah. So, again, not to go on about myself, but you know, one of the roles I've had over time is to do a lot of strategic thinking. And I think you can apply it to most things. People don't like it when you come in an area that's not really your domain, and you start going, okay, asking difficult questions.
Yeah.
But apparently Brailsford is extremely detail-oriented, has a very good eye for structure and strategy, and we'll find out at United whether that's all true. But I think it's really no doubt. You don't have to read between the lines. He's kind of straightforward on saying that. Obviously, they're not going to say, hey, we're going to buy this player and that player. Although, he did say, we're not buying Mbappe, and it's not very clever just to go out and buy the best player in the world. So at least we get a view, a thought on what the transfer strategy might be.
Mbappe is brilliant, though. I wouldn't have ruled it out that quickly. Because he's pretty good. He's pretty good, Sergio.
He's all right. But we don't need another left-sided forward, do we? So
Yeah. I suppose, yeah. Just clog up the system. But no, the principle is it's sound. You can't disagree with it, really. You know, go out. He's saying adopt and change the transfer strategy on that respect. And you can't disagree with it. Again, it's everything. This is where I'm a little bit cautious in getting too excited, is because we have been in this situation before when we've had people appointed in different positions, because when they've talked ahead of making any decisions, generally everything sounds good because a lot of these people are trained to deliver classy statements at this level. And you can have all the great intentions in the world. Everyone wants, who's been employed by Manchester United over the last 10 years, has wanted United to succeed and to be part of the process that elevates them back to being the top, because everyone benefits from that. So the intent is always there. It's the execution, really. So I know I'm going to sound like a broken record with this over the next sort of 18 months, but that's only maybe even take longer than that when you see the sort of fruits of these early planning stages. But you have to be optimistic because there are so many different things in terms of, you know, like the infrastructure of, like, there's money coming in now. He's been addressed at all levels proactively rather than we'll deal with one problem at a time. He's addressing everything. He's accepting responsibility for everything. There's open dialogue, which all of these things are new. So you've got to accept, or you've got to invest faith in someone who is being proactive and opening dialogue at the same time, which is obviously, that's the difference. Yeah. But it might feel like it's the same merry-go-round for us again, you know, oh, another transition, but there is enough difference to be invested in.
All right. So one of the things that may change is the manager, and I don't want to sound like I'm sitting on the fence, but I'm kind of sitting on the fence with Ten Hag. As I tweeted out, I think what gets lost in the wash a lot here is the idea that there'll be a club style that they're looking for, the new Ineos team, and the manager will be based around that. And I don't think we're really clear about whether Ten Hag fits into that. But, like, notwithstanding all of that, the sense I get is they're not making this decision based on the next 10 games or something like that, or whether they make the Champions League by a point or goal difference or not. And because that's not a good way of judging a manager, and they're going to think a bit longer term and think over the next cycle of sort of 3 years. And if they believe in Ten Hag, they'll have to kind of say it this summer, I guess, and go, hey, he's our manager because he's out of contract in 25. You don't really want lame duck manager. And you also want to buy the kind of players that fit with the manager and the club style you want. So there's all that kind of wider decision to make. But, like, a lot of noise was made this week in International Week, when Gareth Southgate is the focus of much media speculation anyway, that Ratcliffe and company, big fans of Southgate, might like to install him at Old Trafford. The story didn't go down well with the United peeps, I would say.
Yeah, it wasn't a very popular rumour. Let's say that. I agree with you being on the fence with Ten Hag, and I think the important thing that Ratcliffe and co are going to have to do is go a little bit of root digging with this one, because you will have to go back to the start and like look at United's history a little bit. Not historically, like way back, but the post-Ferguson history. And this thing that I've been talking about for ages, which is you get a manager to 18 to 24 months, this critical period where they need that other window to sort of exercise full control over the squad for different reasons, mostly financial. I think I will say this about the sort of existing ownership structure before Ratcliffe came in. Ten Hag has been backed within the financial limit that United have got, which has obviously imposed a great restriction on him. Within that, he's been backed to make every strong decision.
Yeah.
There's been no second guessing him. He's been able to get rid of Ronaldo. He's been backed on Sancho. He's been backed with disciplining Rashford, and there are multiple other things to talk about. All of those things, he has been backed, but he still probably deserves then that window of being backed unilaterally through the finances that are there now, that will be there to help him move the club on to the next level. And why does he deserve that? Firstly, because he's done a decent job. We can see from the injuries and everything like that. And when they come back, there's a plan there. Everything's there. You can see the plan. You can see what it is. It looks good and it's effective. And it has United progressing better than what they were mostly under Solskjaer, because there was some progression there. And they look better than they did under Mourinho and Van Gaal. I'm sorry if anyone's got short memories and they want to believe that the football was better under those. Honestly, go back and watch matches of football under them at their best. Go back and watch some matches under Ten Hag at the best, and the difference is night and day. So there are seeds there, and he deserves a chance then. And what's more important than that is that United as a club will only benefit from that stability. The other thing before I get to Southgate is that if there wasn't Ten Hag in post, then they would just want to make a change for the statement of making a change, of saying we're the new guys in town, we're going to bring in a guy. They'd be looking at someone like Ten Hag. I know it's been said in these last few weeks that kind of situation would be the case, but that's what they would be doing. Ten Hag's stock hasn't really been, I don't think it's been badly diminished by what's happened at United this season. I just think he's had a rotten run of luck, and if they looked at it deeper, they would see that. Obviously, results looked at one point like they've run away with him. I don't think we're that bad at the moment. I don't think his future should be determined on, probably more determined on the FA Cup fortunes than it is the Champions League at this point in time, I personally think. So the lack of a great candidate, which then is another, you know what I mean, that stands in Ten Hag's positive column. There isn't one. And then especially when the two that are being talked about are Graham Potter because of his relationship with Ashworth, and this one about Gareth Southgate.
Well, he's also got a relationship with Ashworth because Ashworth was at the
FA. Of course, yeah.
I think that's where a lot of the links come from, yeah. I mean, Ten Hag, yes, actually, you can put it in context, and they have had rotten luck, including this week, weird story that Casemiro was cleared, like, thought he had a problem, was cleared by the United Medical Department, went to his own doctor who found the problem, and pretty weird story, and not very positive for Manchester United's medical department. Just one more piece of evidence that something has gone badly wrong at the club. Because I actually don't believe that all these injuries, except for the impact injuries in games, I don't believe they're all luck, because there's a lot of muscle injuries, and I think there's something not quite right about the sports science and the zoning. So I don't know what it is. Maybe details will come out in time. But yeah, Ten Hag's been unlucky. The plan, I don't know that I'm quite as certain that there is a clarity of plan, because I think it's changed this season. And he has gone fully into this idea that United will be a transitional team. So they're happy for the opposition to have the ball so they can use their fast players, quote unquote, to create dangerous situations. And that's fine as a style. I think for where United are right now, that's perfectly fine, actually. It depends on the team you're playing, of course. But certainly when we're playing some of the top teams, the better sides, then that's all right as a plan. Yeah, I do box defend again, like his term, quite well. Ferran and Maguire, when he plays, I mean, obviously didn't start the weekend. Lindelof, actually, all decent box defenders. They can play quite narrow. They can defend in numbers. They do give away a lot of shots, but I think the betting there is it's kind of low-quality shots. Still a lot of them. Yeah. So that's the strategy right now. It's not one, I don't think, that would win United the league, but we're not there. So the belief has to be that he's got a plan for the next 3 years, and the new team has to believe that he has that plan for the next 3 years as well. So what is he going to take to win a league?
But to interrupt on that point is just that plan that we've seen is not his plan A. It's not a great plan B, but there's such a disconnect with the quality of those players that, all right, it's not great to watch. And you're right, it's not going to win any major on a relay. We've struggled to see if it'll win us the FA Cup unless we get players back. But once we do have the right players in that profile, and once he's able to bring more players in that fit that profile, i.e. a backup to Martinez, who's more like Martinez and not so different that he's Maguire, or a backup to Luke Shaw, who's actually got a left foot, or someone better than Luke Shaw, who's got foot. Until we see these people come in place, then I'm hesitant to judge him too harshly on that. But then, well, I haven't really talked about Southgate and my opinion on him. I don't think it'd be a good fit for United for multiple reasons. I don't think that he's can handle the pressure in that kind of way. I think he's way too pragmatic, which I think works at international level, and it'll work better for him this summer with the midfield that he's got. Well, really, he's got talent all over the squad now, but particularly in midfield and creative. So he can get away with a certain amount of pragmatism. But we've seen from choices in certain players and the way that he goes about disciplining certain players and his selection process, which has been so inconsistent. And I know it has been throughout the years at England, and it's not just Southgate. Obviously since there's been this, the trend of like the foreign players, I don't know what the rota is now. The quota is, but it's got to be something like three to four English players in a team.
Oh, yeah. In the Premier League, the total number of minutes. Yeah, it's in the 20-something percentage, I think.
Okay, so something like that. So but within that quota, he's still looking at players and saying, oh, well, if you're set to one player, if you're not playing for your club, then you're not playing for the country. But then for another player, it doesn't matter. And things like that, he's inconsistent on that. And I don't think, and he's been publicly inconsistent on that. He'd get crucified with that kind of like thinking at United, and that kind of inconsistency. Yeah. Any inconsistency gets apps on a daily basis, gets scrutinized in the week. And I just don't think he doesn't strike me as a proactive, positive appointment.
I couldn't think of a single reason. I don't particularly dislike the guy, although I think his brand of football is quite frustrating. I mean, you can make the argument it's the kind of football that wins tournaments, but he hasn't won a tournament. I mean, he got very close. But yeah. I don't know. I kind of think that he's got the most talented group of English players in a generation. I think it's better than the 2002 squad, actually, if you look at the depth that England have. Maybe not in centre defence, but elsewhere, incredibly talented, and he's been very pragmatic, overly pragmatic with it. It's my kind of view. But like wider than that, there's nothing on the CV that says that he's qualified to be a United coach. I mean, just nothing at all. I think Ollie was more qualified. He'd won league titles. Gareth Southgate managed Middlesbrough. I mean, international football is a completely different sport to the club game. Completely different. We haven't seen anything that tells us that Southgate can do it at the club level.
When Keane stamped on him in 1995, he injected some like United DNA into his testicular area. This is the thing, isn't it? There'll be a groundswell of public opinion that turns the other way if he does win something with England. But it is important to remember all the things that you just said. He's never really commanded. He really got the England job from being
part of the FA setup. Yeah.
Remember how catastrophic it was? Yeah, it was absolutely catastrophic what was happening with England. There was the Hodgson dilemma. There was the Allardyce facade. It was just absolutely farcical for years. And he fell into that position. It's like, he's safe hands. Let's just, and he didn't even seem like a long-term appointment at the time. It was like, let's just get through this next period. And it's worked out better than what's been expected. So even though it is frustrating to watch, it is more successful for England. Keep him in post. I know that he might want to go. If he wants to go, then fine. Doesn't mean he has to walk into the biggest job in football. And I would, this is the thing what I worry about. The only thing I worry about really with Ratcliffe and Brailsford is that they might, obviously there's this idea of, they're talking about, we want to inject more homegrown, they're talking on that kind of path, which is good, but you shouldn't include the England manager in this respect, instance, because he's not the right man.
I can't see anything there. But look, it won't just be Ratcliffe and Brailsford, and they may all be mates with Southgate, who knows, and Ashworth. There's also Berarda, and there's going to be need to be consensus on that. I'd be surprised. But if it did happen, it's also logistically difficult, by the way, because we've got the tournament this summer, and I don't know how you would appoint a... I mean, it wouldn't be the first time an international manager has been appointed to a club during a tournament or in the lead up to the tournament or just after, but it wouldn't help the planning so much. But he'd also come in to the job with so much baggage. I mean, man, he'd need to have results go his way right from the beginning. Otherwise the pressure would be unbelievably big because he just doesn't come with the kind of reputation, inspirational reputation that I think United fans are looking for. So give me a choice between Ten Hag and Southgate, and I'm going to pick Ten Hag every time. And yeah, keep on with that project for all the faults. And I do think he's...
Yeah,
there's been quite a lot of faults this season.
No, I don't disagree with that. And I agree with that. The everything that you just said in sentiment, there's more to be gained from investing in what we've got than... It's just our, obviously, your opinion as well, but mine. But there's more to be gained in investing in what we've got than in speculating on another change and another redirection under Southgate.
Yeah.
Certainly this summer, at least.
Well, it's International Week, and what we don't have, which we used to have on the regular, was a United player going to the, let's say, the French press and speculating about his potential transfer to, I don't know, Real Madrid or something like that. So we don't have to put up with that. What we did have was Kobbie Mainoo, after we talked on this podcast about how it was a disgrace that he wasn't in the England team, being promoted to the full England squad from the under-21s after his masterful performance in midfield against Liverpool at the weekend. And I think well-deserved, just on talent alone. I mean, he hasn't got the experience, I guess, but he wouldn't be the first young player to be picked. I don't imagine Wayne Rooney had an awful lot of experience before he got picked for England. I mean, he definitely didn't.
No,
did he?
I'm just trying to think the Rooney one. Rooney came into... Did he make his debut at the back end of the...
2002, 2003 season.
The back end of a season. And then he started in the 2002, 2003 because I think he was too young. They tried to get him to play at the back end of the previous season, but they couldn't. So he played at the start of the next season. And he played, I think, Leeds and Spurs he played against in early games. And then he scored the goal against Arsenal.
Yeah.
And that was the October, and he scored a couple more goals in the next. He was brilliant, basically, for that first. And then he played for England against Australia.
Yeah, like at Upton Park, was it February? Like that, wasn't it? Yeah.
So February. So we're talking 6 months in. So this is even quicker than that, really. And there is a good comparison. They're obviously very different players, but what you got from Rooney being in the international setup is the fearlessness and the... He wasn't bound by systems and convention. And there's an interesting line that Van Gaal used to say. I mean, you might not say his football was interesting, but he said one thing that was interesting about when he was introducing all the young players into his side. I don't know if you remember it, Ed, but it was kind of like everyone had to play to this rigid formation that they all had to play within this yard-based system where they couldn't run too far out of right back or whatever, but these rules only apply to the senior players, didn't apply to anyone who was just coming into the side. They were encouraged to just go and play, which ironically enough brought about United's best run of entertainment under Van Gaal when Rashford and Fosu-Mensah came in and Pereira when he first broke into the side and Varela, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
There were all these guys who were coming into the side and they were playing really well just for a little period and it wasn't sustainable. But the same rule applies. They applied for Rooney coming in where no one was asking him to do, you know, that would come later in his career, do the hard tactical work and sacrifice. And we saw it again with Mainoo at the weekend. He's meant to be the disciplined older midfielder, but he's obviously, he hadn't been told to worry about that too much because he went on about two long, mazy dribbles when he went through about three or four players. So he can play with that freedom. And really, considering that England have got Bellingham, who plays like that naturally, is it? And he's still only a teenager, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
He might be 20 at the most, but you've got a player who plays like that naturally, but with seniority now, like already one of the established best players in the world. And you got Declan Rice, who has been brilliant for Arsenal, and putting Mainoo in that situation. It's too soon for me as a United fan, but I want to see that. I want to see how he plays in that because he can play with freedom. And that will help him playing alongside midfielders like that. It can't hurt him playing alongside midfielders like that.
It'd be interesting to see what kind of England setup they, if he does, I don't know whether he'll start or not, but England quite thin on, high on quality, but thin on numbers in midfield with Calvin Phillips not playing very well. So they've got Conor Gallagher in there, Bellingham, Rice, and now Mainoo. And that, I think that's it. That like there isn't a lot of numbers there. And depending on what system Southgate plays, if he plays as like 4-3-3 And Bellingham plays in the position he's playing for Real Madrid, which is basically at 10 or more like the, let's call it the McTominay version of the number 10, where he allows to make eight runs. And it's got Bellingham an incredible amount of goals this season. I mean, he's not like a creative number 10 that's going to create a lot of assists, although he's got a few this season, but he's got an incredible amount of goals, like drifting to the box late, space to shoot and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, the McT, Bellingham has learned from the master at this and done very well. So it'd be interesting if Southgate does that, because like you'd look at a midfield of Rice, Maignan and Bellingham, and it's pretty much the perfect balance and all very high quality as well. And a lot of pressure on the young kids going, hey, now you're in the England side. And by the way, we've got an international tournament coming up. But there's nothing about Maignan that tells me that he would be fazed by any of that.
No. I mean, you look at France and they've got Tchouaméni and Camavinga. Yeah. And I know they've got a couple of other great talents in there as well, but those are the two that stand out for me. And apart from that, I think, first of all, yeah, it's obvious that it's one of the potentially dominant midfields in world football. But also, generationally speaking, I know Croatia have also had a great balance in their midfield as well. But you go back to Spain and they had Iniesta and Xavi. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a midfield that's, like you said, it's got everything. They're still so young. But they've also, like Bellingham and Rice, have got a lot of experience as well. And Maignan coming into that with that kind of freedom and also ability to run a game of football. You don't even need him to do that with those players. So it'd be interesting to see how they do work together. That's probably the most interested I would have been in watching an England side, just to see that since our players were in there, like Euro 96, just post that period when the likes of Beckham and Scholes went in, and you're interested to see how they develop, to see how that works. Obviously, I'd want him to stay at United and play more than five games to get an international call-up, because you want to protect him from all the potential criticisms that come from any failure, which will inevitably rest on a United player's shoulders, as it always does. But it will be a good experience for him and a reason for us, because like, obviously in the last couple of years, you do get more invested in the England, because we've had a number of England players in that setup who, like Rashford's done a lot for the country, and when you see him played, and even when Sancho was in there and went sure scoring in an international final, all those kind of things, you do get a little bit more invested in it. And yeah, I kind of now I'm rooting for him to go to the Euros just on that premise, just because I want to see him start. You only want good things for him, and the sky's the limit with him. You don't know how good he could be. So if part of that trajectory is being in England's first choice midfield after a handful of games for United, then brilliant, brilliant. And he deserves it as well.
Yeah, well, England play Belgium and Brazil, I think it is. I've got to admit, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about which games are coming up. So there's Euro playoffs as well, I think, which someone pointed out. I think I mentioned on the pod last time out, like, who cares, basically. But someone said it's Euro playoffs and Wales are involved, so obviously they care. Important for the fine nation of Wales, or Principality of Wales, isn't it? And whoever else is involved. Yeah. All right. I think that's about it for the midweek pod. And we're going to do some bonus content, because I did promise it to backers, patreon.com/NQATpod. We're now doing two bonus episodes a week. One is the general topic that we pick, and the other is the tactics pod with Darnish. Hopefully you caught that. I'm actually going to put it into the main feed as well, so you can get a sense of what we're talking about on that one. But since I mentioned Ratcliffe has been quite strong on this club style thing, whatever that means, we're going to talk about some of the history of that. So it's patreon.com/NQAT. Everyone else will catch you at the weekend. Many thanks. Bye now.